Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program number 532, interview with John Loftus about Intelligence Summit and Unholy Trinity. This has been recorded on November 6th of the year 2005. Once again, it's my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves investigator and author John Loftus, the author of, among other titles, Unholy Trinity, that'll be the focal point of Side 2. John, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thank you, Dave. Glad to be back.
Now, in Side 1, we were talking about a lawsuit for which you are the advisor. This lawsuit has been filed against the Vatican Bank. We were talking about some of the larger geopolitical and macroeconomic implications of the Vatican's financial relationship with German-heavy industry, including during the Nazi period. And what I'd like to talk about now would be some of the so-called rat lines, a name familiar to observers of the intelligence community but unknown to the general public. Perhaps a way of talking about that might be to start with some of the people that we were talking about in Side 1, people who wore dual hats. They were bankers or powerful Wall Street lawyers. They were also intelligence people. Perhaps Alan Dulles might be somebody with whom to start. Tell us about the rat lines and how this hooks up with the Vatican and with elements of Western intelligence.
Well, a rat line is, in intelligence terms, means an escape and evasion network. It's an organized system of people and places used to smuggle people out. For example, when we smuggled out pilots that were shot down over Germany during World War II, there was a rat line that brought them out. Well, the Vatican had its own rat line, and unfortunately, it wasn't to help American pilots; it was to help the Nazi oppressors. The Vatican had an entire series of convents and monasteries from Austria through Switzerland into leading down to Rome, and then they would be given identity cards, sometimes Red Cross passports, and then be trucked to the port of Genoa and put aboard a chartered ship that would take them to Argentina or to Australia, to Canada, and eventually to the United States.
And now these rat lines were not just escape networks, but escape networks run by some very, very powerful people for some very powerful reasons. One of the things you point out in Unholy Trinity is something I'd like to touch on just in passing, because I think it's likely to prove confusing to some people. But these rat lines were conducted for the purposes of intelligence, and we're going to talk about Western intelligence, but all along we should remember that these rat lines, these networks, were penetrated by the Soviets. You want to just briefly touch on the Soviet link before we get into some of the people who were involved with these things?
Yeah, the Soviets knew that the Vatican and some of these rogue elements in British and American intelligence were helping the Nazis escape, or at least turning a blind eye towards it. The Russian communists saw this as a great way to penetrate Western intelligence. By disguising their agents as Nazis, they were able to go out through the rat lines and eventually penetrate all of our Cold War operations. The Cold War was a disaster because when we tried to use some of these Nazi intelligence services and undergrounds, they were totally flipped. The Russians were making fools of us.
Yeah, and there's one of the subtexts in Unholy Trinity is an enormous counterintelligence war that went on for decades. It is one of the things, sort of a spy versus spy phenomenon, that is one of the things that makes
Keystone Cops. It was pretty bad. I read I had very high security clearances, and I read Walter Bedell Smith's address to the Army War College, and Bedell was one of the post-war heads of CIA, and he said the use of these emigre groups was a complete disaster, because they were hopelessly penetrated by the Russians. And, for example, when we tried to send agents behind Russian lines, we lost over 97% of the people we sent. Now, for years, that was censored out of my books by the CIA because they thought it might discourage recruiting in the future. But I think it's important for people to realize that because of these Nazi groups, because of the Soviet penetration of the Vatican, we lost the trust and the lives of innocent human beings all across Eastern Europe that were willing to work with America to fight for freedom. In effect, because of the greed for money by people like Alan Dulles, he perverted the intelligence community where it served his clients' interest, but never served American interest, certainly never served the interest of freedom.
Indeed. On page 114 of the paperback edition, you quote a British intelligence officer who says, the former British officer was almost emphatic that, quote, you can almost talk about interlocking directorships between Western intelligence and the Vatican at this period. We're talking about the rat line period. What if you'd detail that for us, John? How does Western intelligence, how does the Vatican figure into this, the rat lines?
Sure. The Vatican had a group of former fascist priests, principally Eustachis, from Croatia. And these guys were over the top. Some of them, quite frankly, were war criminals. I know this seems horrible to say that a priest could be a war criminal, but believe me, there actually were some. And so this one group of priests from the Ustashi movement was, in essence, trusted with the smuggling of Nazis. That was their primary responsibility. There were a few other orders, the Franciscan Order and the intelligence service of the Jesuits that participated in this. But by and large, it was the Ustashi priesthood that ran the rat line. For a price, they would smuggle anyone out. Sometimes the Western intelligence wanted a certain person smuggled out of Europe, no questions asked. They would pay a price to the Vatican, to Father Dugonovich, and he would arrange for that person to go to South America or Australia. So it was an under-the-counter smuggling system that would serve all customers as long as they weren't communists. And of course, the joke is, once again, Father Dugonovich's clerk was a communist spy, so the information was going to both sides.
Some of the people who were involved in some of these rat lines were, and in all parties, were very powerful. And as we touched about Alan Dulles and people of that ilk, early in the broadcast, we were talking about Archbishop Eugenio Pacelli, the papal nuncio to Munich, who was channeling Vatican monies to Hitler, according to his assistant, Sister Pascalina Lehnert. How does Pius XII, which he later became, how does he figure in the rat line scenario?
Well, you know, after the war, he has a difficult challenge. I mean, he's been silent, neutral in favor of the Nazis, if you will, all during the war, to get the money back. And now he's told if he wants to get his money back, he's got to help the Americans get their money out. So it's the Americans, the British, the Vatican are all helping the Nazis smuggle their money out of Europe before the Russians get their hands on it. So they're all in bed with each other. It's a completely despicable conduct that did none of our nations. I have to emphasize, too, this was not an American policy. This was a Wall Street policy of Alan Dulles. He just happened to be an American intelligence officer, but he was never serving America's interest.
Somebody named Giovanni Battista Montini, a cardinal at the time, but later and better known as Pope Paul VI. He also figures in the rat line scenario. Tell us about Cardinal Montini.
Montini, in effect, worked in the Vatican Secretary of State area and was aware of this program. It was said that he didn't like it, but quite frankly, the evidence is overwhelming that he followed orders, that he participated in the rat lines. We had interviews with people that talked about how Montini, for example, had handed over lists containing the names of people that were to be smuggled out.
Mm-hmm.
So you simply can't say, oh, gee, they didn't know that these were bad people. Of course they knew. The Dugonovich's monastery in Rome, for example, the Church of San Geronimo, had two sets of books. One for people would, you know, register under a false name, and then their true name, giving the true Nazi identity. And, oh, my God, the people that went out, Walter Rauch, the inventor of the gas vans, Eichmann himself, Stengel of Sobibor almost tried to make his way out. All these guys were just absolutely terrible. The last one, the one that got out was Eric Pribke. He was one of the Gestapo officers in Rome and presided over what's called the Ardeatine Caves Massacre, where over 100 young men, women, and children had their hands tied behind their backs and were executed by Pribke in retaliation for a partisan attack on some German troops. After the war, ABC television asked me to help them find Pribke. I identified him immediately from some of our intelligence files.
Just one second, John. The time frame I want to set here, the Pribke story emerged. What you're talking about now is something that took place in the 1990s. In other words, we're not talking about, you know, 1940s, 1950s.
No, in the 1990s, I worked with Sam Donaldson, and we got the last major Nazi war criminal, Eric Pribke, and we caused so much noise that he was extradited from Argentina and taken to Italy and put on trial, and he was sentenced to a prison. Unfortunately, it turns out his prison is a pretty laughable one because there are so many fascists in the Italian government, they're always giving Pribke a break. He was allowed, for example, for reasons of health, to have his prison site moved to his best friend's house on Lake Lugano, the lakeside paradise. Well, that happened this year. The Italian people were so outraged that they demanded that Pribke go back to prison and none of this mollycoddle that's been going on for so long.
Yeah, you indicate in the introduction to the second edition of Unholy Trinity that basically strings are still being pulled and the cover-ups of these networks was still going on in the late 1990s.
Oh, yeah, and there's still an enormous amount of files. There's a battle just being fought in Washington. Congress passed a law saying all intelligence agencies have to declassify their files dealing with Nazis. And some agencies, sadly, notably the CIA, has been fighting tooth and nail. They've just lost a major thing on that, and the CIA is finally going to have to disclose some of their files. I'll believe it when it happened. This stuff is so embarrassing. There are many World War II veterans left alive who will be outraged that when the veterans came home and couldn't find jobs in America, that we were giving financial assistance to fugitive Nazi war criminals.
Mm-hmm.
All so we could protect Alan Dulles's clients' investments on Wall Street.
And as you indicated, some of the people who escaped via the Vatican rat lines were some of the most heinous criminals. Eichmann, Walter Rauch, and others, and it was their Vatican links that helped them get out.
Yeah, a few years ago, I was invited down to Argentina to to address the University of Buenos Aires on the International Seminar on Anti-Semitism. And the government said, we want you to talk about Nazis in America to take the sting away from Nazis in Argentina.
Mm-hmm.
I said, sure, I'll talk about Nazis in America. I'll talk about all the ones that emigrated here from Argentina. They had no sense of humor. They put me in the last day, the last hour of the conference. And that afternoon I got to speak, the whole hall was closed. Oh, Senor Loss, it's a bomb threat against your life. You know, we have to have the doggies search. Little doggies ran in, they killed a couple of hours. There was all a stall. They didn't want me to get up and speak.
Mm-hmm.
And when I finally got to talk, they cut the power cables to the hall. And not just the lights, the entire power cable. So we had to move to another hall. And then they lost the translation equipment, so they had to slow it down to a line by line. And I kept saying, hey, guys, you know, I got to leave at 7 o'clock. I got a flight back to America. And so at 7 o'clock, it's finally my turn to speak. Oh, Senor Loftus, it's time for you to go. We're so sorry. I said, oh, you know what? I made a little mistake in the time zone. I don't have to leave for another hour. Give me the microphone.
Mm-hmm.
So I caught them, you know, suckered them in. And for an hour, I could tell the people of Buenos Aires their real history, that their government sold them out to the Nazis. They were working with the Vatican to sell visas to Nazi war criminals. And the people that they had living in Argentina were among the dregs of the human beings of the world.
Well, your experience reminds me of an old Turkish proverb, he who tells the truth gets chased out of 9 villages. And
You know, when I finished speaking, it was 7 o'clock. I really did have to go. And I ran out of the university and grabbed a taxi. But the taxi driver didn't understand English. I don't speak Spanish. I thought, oh, my God, I'm going to miss my flight. This will be horrible. The governor will never give me another ticket. But then I remembered where I was. I gave the cab driver instructions in German. This he understood perfectly. It was, after all, Buenos Aires.
That is an interesting little anecdote. Talking about some of the people who made it out from Europe to Argentina, you mentioned Antti Pavlich, and some of the interesting facets of his post-war career. If I could ask you, John, tell us who Antti Pavlich was in the context of the Ustashi government, where he was sheltered while he was a beneficiary of the rat lines, and ultimately where he wound up and what he was doing.
Now, imagine the Ustashi were a party that governed Croatia, and they're headed by Ante Pavlich. These guys could nauseate the Nazis. Pavlich bragged to Hitler that he had made sure there were no Jews left in Croatia when there were still Jews living in Berlin. Mussolini was nauseated when Pavlich's Ustashi sent him a bowl that looked like oysters, and they were actually human eyeballs. They had no restraint in atrocities. Their killing center in Jasenovac was one of the most brutal places in the world. Unlike Auschwitz, where they had fairly humane poison gas,
mm-hmm.
instead of it, they had meat hooks, billy clubs, and knives. And the Ustashi recruits were, their blood test was literally to stab, beat, or club a human being to death.
Yeah, there was somebody who owned a restaurant right near the very first radio station that I began working at, right here out in the Silicon Valley, and his parents had been survivors of Jasenovac, and one of them had escaped when the work party was ambushed by partisans, and his mother had been a nurse, and because of that, because they had a hospital at the center of the camp to handle wounded soldiers, she was spared. But their children originally, their first set of children, had been in a children's camp in Jasenovac, which was separated by barbed wire, although the adults could see them. And one morning his father looked and he saw other children wearing his children's clothes and realized that his children had been killed the night before. The way they killed people at Jasenovac, they herded the children into kilns. It was a converted brickyard. They simply herded them into the kilns and then turned on the kilns and burned them alive. I mean, so this was the sort of thing over which Antti Pavlich presided.
Sadly, those kind of extreme atrocities were very, very common in Croatia. It was so bad after the war when Tito took over Yugoslavia, the truth about Jasenovac was literally classified a state secret, and they lowered the casualty rates by 80% because Tito figured if the population of Serbs, Croats, and Yugoslavs ever learned the truth, it would cause them to revolt. And he'd have more blood. There'd be a huge civil war, which, in fact, is what happened years later after Tito died.
Mm-hmm. What happened? Now, Pavlich was a beneficiary of the rat lines, and although I'd known about the rat lines.
My God, he was living in the Vatican, inside the Vatican Library, driving around in a car with Vatican diplomatic plates. And this isn't just hearsay. We had American intelligence agents who were in Rome watching this. Now, one of the agents is a good friend of mine. He's still alive. His name is Bill Gowan. Bill lives in New York City. And he was one of the Army Counterintelligence Corps agents. And we Americans were still out hunting Nazi war criminals when the Vatican and the British were recruiting them. And they spotted Pavlich, and they set up a campaign to arrest him as soon as he stepped outside the car outside Vatican grounds. He was being tailed and didn't know it. Suddenly, orders came down from the U.S. State Department. Hands off. Our State Department, presumably at the request of Alan Dulles, wanted to make sure that Ante Pavlich would not be arrested, that this war criminal would be allowed to escape.
But he was actually be given physical shelter in the Vatican itself.
Inside the Vatican itself, yeah.
And was driving around with a car with Vatican plates.
Yeah, Vatican diplomatic plates, so he couldn't be arrested.
Wow. Now, ultimately, where did he wind up, and in what capacity?
Buenos Aires, and there he worked as an advisor to Perón. His Ustashi thugs became sort of the bodyguards for Evita and Perón. They were the ones that, were the hired mercenaries to protect Perón from assassination or coup.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned, too, that, that of course, obviously, in part one, we touched on the role of the Vatican Bank in helping to affect the Nazi money flowing to Argentina. They also, an awful lot of the personnel went as well.
Oh, yeah, you couldn't get rid of the Nazi money without the Nazi bankers coming and, then friends in the SS. And you let a few in, pretty soon you had a flood.
Mm-hmm.
They actually had chartered steamships going back and forth between Genoa and Argentina to handle the Vatican trade in smuggling Nazis.
Well, let's focus on some of the institutions that overlap this concatenation of Vatican and intelligence collaboration during the early period of the Cold War. Intermarium, what was that, and how you write extensively about it. What was the intermarium, and how does that fit into this pattern?
Intermarium is a Latin phrase that means literally between the seas. It was a Vatican scheme to unite all the Christian Catholic nations of Eastern Europe between the Black Sea and the Baltic Sea in sort of a United States of Central Europe, Intermarium. And the Intermarium project was backed by British intelligence and French intelligence. And sadly, the leaders of Intermarium were, before the war, were the very guys who became the Nazi collaborators during the war. And so when the Vatican went to revive the Intermarium project, they were, in effect, recognizing the validity of Nazi puppet governments. The only one that was happy about this arrangement was the Soviets. They thought it was just hilarious. It was a great way to continue their efforts to sneak agents into America.
One of the groups, too, and this, if I'm not mistaken, also figures into the lawsuit that you have against the Vatican Bank. And who are the Krizari? Now, this is a name that's not known generally.
Krizari is the Croatian language phrase meaning crusader. And we actually had, after World War II, ex-Nazi groups from the former Ustashi party hired into military units called the Krizari. And they would be sent behind the Iron Curtain to kill, capture, and disrupt. And, of course, as I mentioned before, the Soviets had penetration. So the Krizari were eventually betrayed. There were big show trials involving, by the way, several archbishops. And the Krizari ended up causing a lot of misery for people, but never accomplished anything in terms of the liberation.
Now, how were the Krizari being financed?
Oh, there was no doubt about it. I mean, at the trial in Zagreb and from U.S. intelligence records confirmed that the money was being moved to the Vatican. The Vatican was literally laundering money after the war to take ex-Nazi groups, arm them, and send them in to kill. We were using the Vatican as the cutout, if you will.
Mm-hmm. So basically, this was a post-war intelligence operation using looted money through the Vatican Bank and using reconstructed, or just basically reactivated Ustashi personnel.
Yeah, sadly. At least we made them take the swastikas off their uniforms.
Interesting. Now, you mentioned a guy, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, Shreko Rover?
Shreko Rover, yeah.
Shreko Rover.
Shreko Rover eventually ended up in Australia, where my co-author Mark Ahrens is from. And we did a wonderful series on ABC radio down there, Australian Broadcasting. In fact, it was the runner-up for the World Radio Prize, the Armstrong competition. We did a major seven-part series on Nazis down under that exposed Shretzko Rover, who had become involved with politics down there, and his role in leading the Krizari and sending these Ustashi thugs behind the Iron Curtain. And also interesting allegations that Shretzko Rover was one of those communist double agents that we've been trying to uncover at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Because you mentioned that when the Balkan tinderbox, so to speak, was reignited in the 90s, he returned and actually began advising the Croatians in, on some of their excesses during the most recent round of Balkan wars.
Yeah, a lot of the old Croatian Nazis came back to Croatia after the fall of communism. And you can see that the black and white checkerboard flag is now being featured prominently. That was the Ustashi flag. At some of the soccer games, you can hear the chants, 1, 2, 3, Ustashi are we. Sadly, you know, World War II is over and the Nazis won. These guys escaped. Their money's intact and they made it out.
Yeah, the one of the things you mentioned, too, dovetailing some of the material from Unholy Trinity with some of the material you wrote about in The Secret War Against the Jews, and that is the April 10th holiday and the entire Nazi emigre community that came in here under the auspices of the Crusade for Freedom.
Oh, this is where I really got annoyed, yeah. April 10th was the day they established when Hitler created the puppet state of Croatia for the Ustashi under Ante Pavlic. And would you believe that the Ethnic Outreach Committee of the Republican Party celebrated April 10th on the calendar as Croatian Independence Day? It's like having Hitler's birthday be on, you know, part of the Heritage Foundation series. It's something that Americans should honor. So it's craziness. Sadly, a lot of these groups, the Eastern European ethnic groups, that Dulles fought in, when Dulles became a rising star under the he became head of CIA under the Eisenhower administration. His brother was Secretary of State. And they conceived of the idea of using the Eastern European Nazis to get out the Eastern European ethnic vote in America for the Republicans to offset the Jewish vote in the United States for the Democrats. And sad to say, some very, very stupid things were done. I am the first to say that the Republican Party really knew nothing about this. This was a tiny group of corrupt officials that kept the scam going for a long, long time. Among them, it appears to be that President Bush's father, who had been head of CIA, was a little bit knowledgeable of some of these activities, because we found letters from the Bush administration written to Nazis, particularly Nazi war criminals, that we later prosecuted the Justice Department, saying, don't worry, we'll take care of you.
The Crusade for Freedom also embraced some other luminaries, again, although small in number, people who were very powerful.
The Crusade for Freedom, I did an expose on 60 Minutes back in 1982, and there was a film clip of a very young Ronald Reagan asking American school kids to send their money to the Crusade for Freedom to help battle communism. And what the kiddies didn't know was that their money was just being used as a cover. Most of the money was coming right out of U.S. intelligence and CIA and vouchered funds and going to fund these post-war Nazi networks, going to the Khazari, for example.
Mm-hmm. Very quickly, before we wrap up here, John, in the Crusade for Freedom, again, one of the endpoints of some of the Vatican ratline networks we've been talking about, the roles of Richard Nixon and later William Casey.
Richard Nixon. There was a guy who once promised the Nazis that if they could, he could just deliver the vote for presidency for him, he would make sure they were a permanent part of the Republican National Committee. And he would take them out of the closet, if you will. And that's when a lot of this Nazis in America stuff began to bubble to the fore. I'm sorry, I have a lot of great Republican figures I admire, but Richard Nixon I'm opposed to for environmental reasons. He was a waste of valuable oxygen. My favorite Nixon tape is where he turned to a friend of his in the Oval Office and said, you know, if I were to drop an atomic bomb on Tel Aviv, there would still be American Jews stupid enough to vote for me.
Mm-hmm. How about William Casey's role in the Crusade for Freedom?
Yeah, you know, was one of those guys who was in OSS with Bill Donovan right after the war. He's believed to have been one of the principal components in helping to set up the rat lines. He had several charities that he headed that were directly linked to providing financial assistance to move the Nazis down the rat lines. Not a nice guy.
Mm-hmm. With regard to this small cabal, at least, I guess one could say of the GOP, that the party of George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, and Norman Rockwell was the party of George Lincoln Rockwell.
Yeah, I mean, Teddy Roosevelt was stuttered at all. My favorite Republican, here's a guy that tried to drive the cartel and monopoly people out of the country, only to have the worst elements of them come through the back door for the intelligence community.
Mm-hmm.
And please, I want to emphasize again that this is a tiny minority of officials. It's not reflective of the U.S. intelligence community or of the Catholic Church or of America. This was a small group of people who did it for the money. They sold us out for money.
Mm-hmm. John, a question. In other interviews, we've spoken about Grover Norquist and some of the GOP figures who basically flacked for some of the very most extremist Islamic elements, people associated with the Muslim Brotherhood and the Bank al-Taqwa, with roots going back to this same milieu. Do you see a parallel between, you know, the Dulles, Casey, Nixon cabal, and maybe some of the ways that Grover Norquist and some of the others have recruited the most extreme Muslims into the Republican ethnic cosmology, so to speak?
Yeah, funny you bring that up, because I'm just working with Hollywood to do a film about that, about the Brotherhood. The Brotherhood was the Arab Nazis. Very briefly, they worked for the Third Reich during the 30s and 40s. They were half a million strong. They were the spy service for the Third Reich. They tried, Saddam Hussein's uncle, for example, was an Arab Nazi, the man who raised him, and was part of the abortive Nazi coup in Iraq. And in World War II, all the Arab Nazis disappeared. They disappeared because the British Secret Service was hiding them. They were using the Arab Nazis in 1948 to attack the infant state of Israel. The Nazis were defeated. They fled back to Egypt, but Nasser didn't want them either, so they booted the Arab Nazis out. And that's when our Dimwits and our CIA came in. We took the Muslim Brotherhood over and resettled them in Saudi Arabia. Now, these Egyptians were by and large illiterate in some college educations. They became the school teachers. They ran the madrasas. Literally, Saudi Arabia imported the Nazis of the Muslim Brotherhood to run public education in Saudi Arabia. And so we had young men like Osama bin Laden being trained by Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we get this intersection of Saudi religious bigotry and Nazi racism, and you created a perfect storm of hatred, you know, what we now call Al-Qaeda. Now, the idea was that we'd have the Arab Nazis as a counterweight to the Arab communists during the Cold War. But and every once in a while, we take the Arab Nazis out of the closet. And the last time we did that was in the 80s in Afghanistan. Now, we couldn't call them Arab Nazis or Muslim Brotherhood. That name was too well known as a Nazi name. So we could call them Mujahideen, and we laundered the money through Saudi Arabia. But essentially, it was the same old Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
Yusuf Nada, the old Nazi from the Bank al-Taqwa, they were involved with this stuff. And in 1989, you know, the Russians were defeated. The CIA celebrated, went home, and left this huge army of Arab Nazis out in the field.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the most radical younger half split off and became what we call Al-Qaeda. But Al-Qaeda is the direct descendant of the Arab Nazi group, of the Muslim Brotherhood. They're not Nazi-like. They are Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're the direct descendants of them. It's, in fact, the Osama bin Laden's mentor, Azam, was himself a member of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Mm-hmm.
His right-hand man, Dr. al-Zawahiri, is the head of the Muslim Brotherhood splinter faction, the radical Egyptian Islamic Jihad. So the Muslim Brotherhood is the parent organization of all the Sunni-based groups, and it is a direct descendant of the Third Reich.
And you pointed out in our past discussions that this resulted in the Grover Norquist sponsorship of these people.
Oh, I'm resulted glad you brought that name again. Yeah, Grover Norquist is the most powerful lobbyist in Washington, and he was hired by the lobby, by the terrorists. They hired Grover Norquist to be their lobbyist, to keep the FBI off their back, and Grover Norquist's best friend is the White House Chief of Staff, Karl Rove.
Mm-hmm.
So there were guys hired in the White House to screen out, well, in effect, they were screening out the moderate Muslims, and only the right-wing extreme Muslims could get their pictures taken with the president. So you had guys like Al-Amoudi and Sami Al-Aryan, both of whom are now indicted as terrorists, by the way, in America, were very close to Norquist in the White House. So there were actually guys from the Muslim Brotherhood, the second-generation Arab Nazis, who had better access to the White House than you and I ever will.
Continuing the same pattern that we'd seen with the Vatican. John
says he didn't know that they were Nazis. He didn't know they were terrorists. Yeah, okay.
Well, we are out of time here, John, unfortunately. Your website again real quick.
IntelligenceSummit.org.
And that is the place to learn about the Intelligence Summit. We've been visiting with John Loftus, and this concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 532, being recorded on November 6th of the year 2005. For John Loftus, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.